And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, May the 9th, 2017. 1:12 coming up on 1:13 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Scott Spears along with you here on the Now program. And today we have one of my favorite guests because heavens knows there is a lot going on in Washington between former Attorney General Sally Yates testifying yesterday, James Comey, head of the FBI, testifying last week, whole thing last night with Jared Kushner's sister and things going on overseas, healthcare vote that passed Congress and is now into the Senate, and we've just learned that Senator Lindsey Graham wants to know Trump's business dealings. That's his quote. Nobody would know more about this than one of our favorite frequent guests. We're always so glad to have her on. She was a longtime panelist on the long-running television series, one of my favorites, still miss it to this day, the McLaughlin Group. She currently writes for the Daily Beast. Check it out. She is Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm doing okay. Trying to keep up with everything and make sense out of it, if possible. The challenge.
You know, Eleanor,
always more questions than answers.
Now, is it a good time to be a reporter in Washington? You've been there for a while. Is this a good time?
I think the whole journalism business is going through a renaissance. We may not like how it performs all the time, but subscriptions are up for the print media. I think their ratings are up for all the cable news shows. So, yes, I think it's a very good time to be in the news business.
When did the news business become the new Hollywood?
Oh, that's an interesting way to put it. You know, you can go back right after Woodward and Bernstein and the bringing down of a president. I think that kind of glamorized the job, and you had a lot of, young people in journalism schools that were there because of Woodward and Bernstein. But I think a heavier glamorization, less Hollywood and more Kardashian, I think is what we're looking at more recently. It's just kind of a celebrity worship. And I think a trivialization of a lot of journalism. And I think that would be epitomized in the phrase clickbait, which is kind of a byproduct of the social media world we live in. So, yeah, so I think there are different phases of a phenomenon that began quite a long time ago with Woodward and Bernstein.
What I am shocked about is when I go to the grocery store and I'm going through the checkout line. Now, I've been doing this for many years, and the tabloids were always filled with movie star gossip. Now, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and President Obama are on every tabloid cover.
Well, I think the tabloids were pretty eagerly following the Clintons when they were in the White House. Now, maybe that lapsed with George W. Bush, and I think there wasn't much tabloidy about Barack Obama's administration, but now I think everything is viewed through that lens. And Trump is just, he's the center ring in every circus you can imagine. So not only the tabloids, he's all over the front pages of the newspapers and the serious policy journals too. I mean, he's active on so many fronts, I think, that, you know, every aspect of the media world is, you know, scrambling to keep up with him. And he kind of bragged about it. I think at that 100-day rally in Harrisburg, he pointed to the press, of course, in the roped off area and said, "Look at them, they're exhausted." And, you know, he was speaking some truth there. And you talk to, for example, the Washington Post bureau chief at the White House, Phil Rucker, says, you know, every day it's a balancing act. You know, where should we be putting our true energies? What should go above the fold? Where are we simply, you know, kowtowing to his latest tweet? Where is the genuine news? So I think you know, journalists are challenged in this new environment.
Eleanor, it was just reported on CNN, is where I pulled that Senator Lindsey Graham big muckety-muck in the Republican Party says he wants to see President Trump's business holdings. Does that mean anything? A lot of people have wanted to see these.
Well, I give Lindsey Graham a lot of credit for the handling of the hearing yesterday with Sally Yates. I mean, he's the chairman of that subcommittee, I believe, and he really pushed to have her there, and he seems to be, determined to perform in a even-handed way in that role, and the fact that he said that, I mean, my goodness, it's been obvious for quite a long time that what we're missing with this president is the look at his tax returns, which could tell us a lot about his foreign holdings and whether he did get loans from Russian banks and so forth. So, what Lindsey Graham said was such an obvious requirement, and you do have, I think, when you do polls and you ask people if we should see his tax returns, it's way up in the 60s or low 70s, and that includes a lot of Republicans as well. So, but that's the first kind of real crack in the Republican wall protecting the president against the pursuit of those tax records, because the Congress could get them. They could subpoena them. If they really wanted those tax records, they could get them.
What is the worst case scenario? Because he's been holding on to these for a long time now. What is the worst case scenario if he releases them? For him?
The worst for him. I guess it would reveal his falsehoods. They could be relatively minor falsehoods about how much money he's given to charity or the millions he says he's paid in taxes. Maybe that doesn't exist, or that he's not as wealthy as he likes us to believe he is. But I think the real serious jeopardy is where the money comes from. And this comment that I think it was Eric Trump made to a reporter with a golf magazine a couple of years ago, which repeats, I think, what he had said earlier to someone else about how our money comes through Russia. And he said during the recession they couldn't get money from banks for all the golf resorts, and yet the Trump properties were expanding. And he told this golf reporter, not thinking that it was any kind of a secret, this is before the Trump campaign got underway, clearly, not thinking it was a secret, and saying, oh, we get our money from the Russian banks. So that would be very important to know, and could explain the reticence of this administration to wait 18 days before firing General Flynn after being told he'd been compromised. Or it could explain the fairly generous comments made earlier about Russian President Putin. So I think the tax returns are like the Rosetta Stone here that everyone is after, because you just wonder why he has gone to such great lengths to conceal them after saying he would release them once the audit was audit, and I can't believe it's never not done. But, presidents routinely reveal their filings every year, and so he hasn't done that either, so we don't see anything. There's got to be some secret there that he's going to do everything he can to protect.
Is there anything in there that could be illegal? Is the Russian thing, if it is true that some of his money comes from Russian banks, does that make something he's done illegal? Because worst case scenario, people have forgiven him for a lot of things. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm thinking illegality would be in money laundering or shell corporations. And now I'm not a lawyer, so this probably there is aspects of that can pass legal muster where the illegality can arise. And I think the focus on Paul Manafort and some of his holdings in Cyprus, I mean, that I think that investigation is still going on. So I think, and then you look at the Kushner family now sort of openly courting investors from overseas. Now that's a different matter. I don't think that's illegal, but now we're getting into serious conflicts of interest, and the whole Trump administration, all the policies seem, you know, designed to enrich the president and those closest to him. So that could bleed over into illegality as well.
Now, former Attorney General, acting Attorney General Sally Yates yesterday testified before Congress. And it's kind of confusing because she says three times she went to the president's counsel and told him that General Flynn could be compromised, and that obviously this information got back to President Trump, we assume, 18 days before the Washington Post story, which led to General Flynn's dismissal. What's the meat of this story?
The meat of the story is, I think, what Sally Yates said, that she expected action, that she thought that this was a fairly significant piece of information she was passing along, that the National Security Advisor was potentially compromised by an adversarial power. And the fact that she was called back a second day after giving what the White House characterized as a heads up, she was called back a second day and asked, you know, why would it matter if one top official lied to another top official? And, you know, these are questions that just kind of blow your mind that it could get that far. So I think that's the salient thing, is that she issued what she thought was a pretty significant alert, and the White House did not respond. And then we learn later that President Obama, when he met with President-elect Trump just 48 hours after the election in that Oval Office meeting, that President Obama told Trump that, or advised Trump, I guess I should say, that it would not be wise to have hire Michael Flynn as his national security advisor. So these are some pretty serious warnings, and why they chose to ignore them or to dismiss them as fake news, which is their kind of favorite phrase, is still, I think, still is a big mystery.
What puzzled me about that testimony yesterday, President Trump, I guess, is allowed to do whatever he wants to do when it came to keeping Michael Flynn on or not. But Sally Yates, as you say, went to his personal counsel three times, had these meetings, said he believed he was compromised. Now, we assume the personal counsel talked to the president about this. And it all came down to, in the end, Flynn lying, saying something that sent the vice president out to lie. Now, if you're Vice President Pence right now, Trump had to have known that he sent him out there with a lie for 18 days and sat on that. Mike Pence is not a dumb man. Mm-hmm. What is he thinking today?
I also have questions about Mike Pence. I mean, he was put in charge of the transition. Remember when they ousted Chris Christie and put Pence in charge of the transition? So seems to me this information about Flynn must have made its way to the vice president-elect as well. I don't know that claiming innocence is going to repent throughout. Of course, we're not going to be able to call him to testify. And I suppose if he didn't know anything, then as the vice president, he was excluded from the inner circle. Now, maybe that's possible, but he did head the transition. And filling out the National Security Council is a pretty big part of the transition. And if there was some information along these lines, you would think that Mr. Pence would have had some knowledge also. And then they, whoever was in the loop, which would be the president and certainly would be the attorney, as you point out, they allowed Pence to go out there and say things that they knew weren't correct. And if it weren't for a Washington Post story, I'm not so sure that Mr. Flynn might still be National Security Advisor. It's extremely reckless, to say the least. And why would they take those reckless steps? And then you also, if you zero back to General Flynn, I mean, he had a very high-ranking position in the Obama administration, and he surely knows the ground rules for communicating with foreign operatives, and that he could be so brazen in his contacts with the Russians is also confusing. He must have known what was at stake, and yet he did it anyway. That doesn't add up either.
Well, what is the likelihood? Because what we know for sure, and this is a puzzle, but what we know for sure is that Flynn, who was just a civilian in December, around Christmas time, made these calls to Kislyak and did say, these sanctions that are coming up, don't worry about them. He did do that. Now, based upon that, what is the likelihood that nobody ordered him to do that?
Well, he did that, and we know that because of the surveillance, but he said publicly that, as I recall, that he didn't, the sanctions did not come up, and that's what he told Pence, right? And that's what Pence went out and said. So that's the lie. So, you know, why would he do that? It beats me. And I wish we could hear from General Flynn. And he offered to testify, but I think he wanted immunity. And the congressional committees did not want to give him immunity.
Well, what?
And that's probably appropriate if you're putting together an investigation.
Well, what makes this all bizarre to me is here's Flynn, and the two things he said when he asked for immunity. Number one, the fact that you're asking for immunity is saying you might have done something illegal here. And number two, he even said, I've got a story to tell. Now, why would you? That's amazing to me.
Why? That do you think that by saying that he jeopardizes his legal situation?
Well, I think that he said it because he wants them to give him immunity because he thinks that Congress and the Senate want to finger somebody in the administration. So he's saying, Listen, somebody over me did give me the order to do this, but I'm not going to do it unless you give me immunity. I thought that's what that was.
Right. Okay, well, and that's usually, that's done quietly, and, you know, the Senate and House committees then presumably conferred with the FBI, and the FBI steered them away from that because it's an active investigation. So, you know, if you go back to when Ollie North testified in the Iran-Contra, they did give him immunity, and I think that made it more difficult for the legal aspects to go forward. So, yeah, so I think the larger case here is taking precedence. But, you know, I don't know Flynn personally, but what I've read about him is he really is kind of a wild figure in a way that was one of his assets. I mean, he was kind of ready to take risks when others weren't, and he was considered one of the, you know, the great intel minds of his generation. So the man is not, or at least wasn't, wasn't a clown by any means. And yet this behavior is so extremely reckless that it goes beyond even the personality type that he's described to be. So, you know, you raise correctly, there are whys and wherefores about Flynn and about the gap in time. So this is a conundrum that is a long way from being understood.
I think the piece of the puzzle here, and I think I brought it up earlier, that's a little disturbing is that, again, Flynn was removed because he said this Kislyak conversation before he was in his position that took place in December when President Obama was still president. He said, don't worry about these sanctions. We now do know that. Now, he said he didn't do that, but then he reversed himself because of the intel. So we know that that mm-hmm. happened. So, again, Flynn, even if he wanted to, even if he's acting on his own in December, he can't promise Kislyak that that's not going to happen. Doesn't that have to come from a higher source? Doesn't somebody have to order him?
Oh, well, I don't think it's a question of ordering. I think he spent a lot of time with Donald Trump on the plane in those last weeks of the campaign. He was at all the rallies. He heard all the pledges. I think he understood or understands what's in Trump's mind on this issue. So, granted, he couldn't do that on his own, but I think he intuits that where that order is coming from. Now, is he just intuiting in it, or did he and Trump have conversations like that on the plane and before the election and soon after the election? That's what we don't know. And we don't know whether Flynn is prepared to say what he knows and to perhaps, you know, there are not too many people above Flynn. I can only think of one, and that's Mr. Trump. I don't think it's a question of bringing down, you know, Jared Kushner or, you know, Steve Bannon or any of the other characters in the West Wing. The Russia affection and the commentary about Russia, which seems so out of place given where the rest of the Republican Party stands and where American policy was directed, seems so out of character, and there are only two people participating in that, and that was Trump and Flynn. People who really think the president is compromised, believe that that's where this is going to end up, tarnishing, severely compromising Trump. But then you have others, Senator Chris Murphy, the Democratic senator from Connecticut, who was pretty definitive when he said, you know, he doesn't see any smoking gun. Then you have Clapper, who headed the NSA, who testified. Now, he wasn't apprised of everything that they were doing, but there are some cautionary notes here that nobody's yet come up with any real evidence of collusion, which is what the investigators need if they're going to prove that there's a real crime that has occurred here.
It's interesting you mentioned that term collusion, because I had noticed that MSNBC is a little different. They tend to the liberal side, so they've mentioned collusion quite a bit. CNN has tried to stay away from that word in implying that it happened. Now, last night, after the Sally Yates testimony, I did notice for the first time that CNN was talking about collusion, in that non-illegal collusion, I forget the panelist who said it last night, but non-illegal collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians just happened in the fact that these emails were leaked and Trump was talking about them. And Trump said, you know, try to hack her emails and so on and so forth. So there was collusion. Right. That's not illegal collusion, right, but it's collusion. Now, the other thing is how could all these people in the Trump campaign have connections, trips, meetings, left forms blank, Kushner left the form blank when it came to foreign meetings? Is there ever a coincidence like that in life?
There are a lot of coincidences, do they add up to anything more than coincidences? I mean, it does look like a deliberate effort to downplay or to keep private information that they knew would be controversial, and I'm sputtering here because, you know, Kushner and his wife, Ivanka Trump, they have very good legal advice. Jamie Gorelick, who was a top official in the Janet Reno Justice Department, who identifies as a Democrat. She's with a major law firm, and she's advising them. So unless they kept that secret from her, too, you just wonder how do people think they can get away with this? That's the other thing. And then you think, well, maybe it just was, you know, innocence, that they have so many connections. And it's hard for us ordinary people to grasp the vast holdings of the Trump family and the Kushner family. And so maybe some of these things seem incidental to them. But again, nobody's come up with anything hard and fast. You still have lots of allegations and lots of, wonderment as to why people behaved in a certain way. And you can connect those dots and can come up with a pretty serious indictment of this administration, or you can look at a pretty hostile media and say the media is just, you know, looking for unicorns that don't really exist.
You know, what put this back on the map for me, Eleanor, was last weekend during the French election, when basically Russia did the same thing to one of the candidates, but he got the court order so the media could not publish this, could not do anything with it, because he knew what was happening. It was dumped on the internet. Now, what was funny about that, maybe not funny, but ironic, is that same thing that happened to Hillary Clinton, yet when you say that to people in the United States, you say, well, even if Russia did this, and I think 90% of the country is sold that they did interfere in the election, even if they did dump Podesta's emails, that didn't change anybody's votes. Well, in France, he certainly thought it was going to.
Well, it didn't change anybody's votes, except the email dump from WikiLeaks happened, I believe 24 hours after the Access Hollywood video emerged that was really undercutting Trump. I think it was the only time during the campaign where he actually apologized. I think he thought that was it. And then the media, we were all off to the races with the juicy tidbits in the emails from John Podesta's, the campaign manager's, email. So, you know, how do you measure in a very close election? It was, you know, three states she lost, really within the margin of error. I think the Comey intervention was a serious blow, but the WikiLeaks was drip, drip, drip every day for weeks there in the campaign. And the media in this country did not act responsibly, in the sense that collectively we just skated over the fact that this was a hacking job promoted probably by Russia, and just went for all the good stuff, which did not make Hillary Clinton and her campaign look good. So, I think they didn't change, they didn't go into voting machines and change individual votes, although apparently they did explore trying to do that as well. But they certainly had an impact on our election. And, you know, it's up to people to what they whether they think that was determinative or not.
And apparently Hillary Clinton thinks it's determinative, because in her interview last week, that and misogyny, she says, were the two top reasons. She admitted she did some things wrong, but apparently there's going to be a whole book in the fall that tells us why she lost the election.
Well, I think she said the Comey intervention, I think she has other people backing that up. That really stopped her momentum. She had a nice healthy lead in the polls, and then they came back 3 days before the election. Comey did, and okay, there's nothing to see here. You had the Trump people, Trump voters were furious because they figured, okay, it's the rigged election, and so they were really energized to come out and vote, whereas I think Clinton is right that she lost a lot of potential support with the initial Comey intervention. But, you know, she did not have a clear message that people could take with them, and he kind of rode the moment in a very broad field, and, he did not win a majority in the country of the vote, and he got through the primaries because there were so many candidates. He was a plurality winner in the primaries, and now you have the Republican Party is trying to reexamine their primary schedule to make sure another Donald Trump never happens. So I think there are a lot of regrets coming out of how the election was handled last year.
I want to switch over here, Eleanor, in the moments we have left, and talk about health care. What happened last week that drove this health care bill through the House that did not happen back in March?
Because the Republican members of the House were convinced that if they didn't deliver on their promise of 7 years, that they would be punished. And they were willing to get a piece of legislation that is as gerrymandered as the Congress, of putting together amendments and assertions so that you could get the moderate votes and you could get conservative votes. And they just wanted to toss the hot potato to the Senate. And the initial bill got 17% approval, and this bill, if anything, is even worse. There's no way it gets through the Senate as is. Now, is the Senate going to be able to find the magic formula where they can keep the handful of moderates they have and still satisfy the very assertive Tea Party faction in the Senate? It seems to me it's an impossible task, and if they do it, you know that the American people are going to pay the price, because this legislation is really just a big tax cut for the wealthy that's masquerading as a health bill. Takes millions out of Medicaid and out of the support for subsidies for people to help them buy insurance.
If the Senate does not come to a consensus, I mean, they can only lose 3 votes, I think it is. If the Senate Republicans lose 3 votes,
right,
does it just go away? Are we back to the drawing board?
Well, it would be back to the drawing board, and how long this will take, probably months. And I think the Republicans are genuinely torn between fearing the political losses of not acting on their campaign promise and fearing the political losses if they act on their campaign promise and deliver such a flawed product. I mean, there's a lot of anger at these town hall meetings. Healthcare is a huge portion of the economy. A lot of people's very lives depend on it, and they're just, you know, mucking around in it like, you know, to satisfy political impulses. And a lot of people are terrified that they're going to lose their health insurance, or it's going to be so expensive they can't afford it. If you give the governors the ability to waive certain provisions, and you give the insurance companies the ability to charge more if you're if you've got a pre-existing condition. So we're kind of back into where the problems were before Obamacare came in, and Obamacare is far from perfect, but it is fixable. And the nice ending to this would be if both parties sat down and just kind of fixed the plan that we have now, as opposed to trying to just recreate a new plan from the beginning that seems to be worse than anything we've had before.
If the Senate loses those three votes, does Obamacare just stay in place? Is that the way it goes?
Oh, yes. In fact, Paul Ryan already said that Obamacare is the law of the land for the foreseeable future. But, you know, the Trump administration could be vindictive enough to continue to undermine Obamacare by, you know, pulling the plug on certain subsidies. And so then they can say, see, we told you so. It was going to collapse of its own weight. And, you know, that's why we needed the rescue mission. It's all about politics. It's really not taking into account the real needs of the American people when it comes to health care.
Why is it that Republican governors, our own governor, Kasich, is against this? Why? I mean, he doesn't like Obamacare. He wants to see something different. But why is that something different totally impossible? That can
why
get through.
Is something different? It isn't. You can't have something totally different because strict market, care does not work with health care. People are not in a position to go shopping around to find the best price on an operation and so forth. And there's not enough transparency in the price of drugs, in the price of various procedures. And you only would get that if you brought in more government regulation, which the Republicans are not going to do. You can, you know, bolster what is in place, and you can do that, and you can enable the insurance companies to be competitive enough so that they stay in the game. The alternative is to have, you know, Medicare for all, and which we have a government program that works quite well. The fact is, and then people buy supplementary programs through insurance companies. The thing is that the insurance industry has such a stranglehold on health care in this country that if you're going to assume that that doesn't change, then you can make do with the changes that the Obama administration put in place, and you can end up with a pretty satisfactory system. People are not unhappy with Obamacare for the most part. There are specific people, like some small business people who make too much to get subsidies. That can be fixed legislatively, and that's what they really should be doing.
Isn't that the big problem with Obamacare in general, is that the small business person who just makes enough to where they can't get subsidies has to provide employees with health care, and it runs, it cuts their profit way down. Isn't that the big problem? Wouldn't Obamacare, in your opinion, have a 75-80% approval rating if just that was yanked out of it?
I think, you know, you have to have 50 employees before you're required to have health care. So I don't really know if that is a significant problem. I know they have a great trade association and they complain a lot, and maybe they do have some, but I'm thinking more of individuals with smaller companies, and they're not providing for other people. They're just trying to provide for themselves. I think that's a problem. But the Republican plan that you could have link all these people together somehow in these big networks seems a little fanciful also. So, again, if you had people of goodwill wanting to make some fixes, this is all doable. And President Trump has discovered how complicated health care is, because you fix one little corner of it and then that affects another corner. And, one survey says that, if they actually manage to just end Obamacare and not sufficiently replace it, healthcare jobs are a huge engine in the economy, too. So they could affect the many months of economic growth that President Obama began and that have continued into this administration. So this is not an area of the economy that you can simply change with a bill that hasn't had any hearings or hasn't been costed out. It's a political con job and very little else.
The buzzword we keep hearing is that President Trump and the people in Congress say it does cover pre-existing conditions, and then the Democrats say it does not cover pre-existing conditions. What is the truth?
Well, it covers pre-existing conditions, but it doesn't put a cap on how much insurance companies can charge you if you have a pre-existing condition. And so there have been studies done by various think tanks in Washington as to what your policy would cost if you had this or that pre-existing condition. So you can say it covers it, and in many ways insurance companies always covered it. If you could pony up the amount of money, you need, if you believe in insurance, you have to get everybody in the pool, and you have to get younger people in, and they may pay a little bit more when they're younger, but they're going to get more than that back when they're older. That's been the theory behind medical insurance. And the Trump administration doesn't want to require anybody to have insurance, so that way a lot of people who aren't sick don't get in the pool until they are sick. And then you end up only with sick people in the pool, and it gets very expensive. So, they're by rewriting Obamacare, they're trying to rewrite the rules that govern insurance in general, and they're going to find that's impossible.
What is this thing I've been hearing at town halls that you do not get refused care in the United States? You can always go to the emergency room.
Oh, that is true, because we don't let people. At least we don't think we'd like to let people die on the street. So if you go to an emergency room, they're required to treat you. But if you've been in an emergency room lately, if you've got insurance, you get treated a whole lot faster than if you don't. And if you don't have insurance, it's they don't make you feel welcome, and they will dun you with bills, on into the future for a good long time. So it is not. It's not a good system for people to be accessing the emergency room only when they're in dire need.
For people out there right now who are wondering about their health care, in your mind's eye, how long is this going to get batted around the Senate? And in the end, do you think it will pass?
They would like to get something done before the August recess. A lot of my political friends think that there's no way they can square this circle, that they can't pass it. But I would not underestimate the willingness of the Republicans to roll over in the end, because this is their guy in the White House. This is their promise that they made. I don't think there is a single Republican in the House or Senate that didn't promise to repeal and replace Obamacare. So there's a powerful incentive there to get something. And I think it's 50-50 whether they can pull it off. But the fact that they name a working committee that is all men, and they exclude Susan Collins, who's a moderate, who's been working on health care issues forever, and who did support Obamacare, I believe. And they leave out Lisa Murkowski, who's taken some tough votes on this issue and has been outspoken. When women's health care is a huge portion of what's at stake here, in the changes that they're proposing, they're either totally tone deaf, or they're just trying to rig something that will please the right wing base, and they figure they can only lose two votes, because they can then bring in Pence. They have 52 votes. I guess they figure they can lose Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski. They lost them on a rule that was had to do with Planned Parenthood, and Pence came in and was the passing vote, and that's could well be how this turns out.
Final question, Eleanor: is there something going on in Washington that's kind of just on the back burner right now that we should be looking out for? Something we don't know.
I think the anxiety about the Paris climate bill, the White House was going to have a meeting about it, and they were kind of really talking tough about pulling out and so forth. I think they're getting a lot of pushback from Republicans, from corporations, from business groups, saying, look, we've accepted climate change is real. There's actually money to be made in climate mitigation. Do we really want to bail out of this? So I think there's a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering on that particular issue.
Eleanor Clift of the Daily Beast, check her out. Eleanor, it's always a great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Scott.
Bye-bye. And that's all the time we have today. Hope you've enjoyed it. Come back tomorrow. But for this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Or something.
I refuse to answer on the grounds.
Yes, I was born right here, Charles. I never went in.